This is what the Buddha says next. This is what the Buddha says next in the Dhammakaya Sutra. First he says, Minepa. What does me mean in Tibetan? All the M words.
Negative.
Alright? Minepa means doesn't stay. Does not stay. And it's in your reading and you might be confused. That's why I wanted to let you know what it meant. Okay? Minepa means not staying. Not staying. It means a person who's not staying in the grasping of self-existence. Otherwise you wouldn't catch it. Minepa means not staying in grasping to self-existence. Changsem means Changchu Senpa. What's that? What's a Changchu Senpa? Changchu means Bodhi. Senpa means Sattva. Changchu means Bodhi and Senpa means Sattva. So what's a Changchu Senpa?
Bodhisattva.
Right. So a Bodhisattva who doesn't stay where? In grasping to self-existence. Okay. Jimba jina, Jimba is the first perfection. What's that?
Generosity.
Giving. Okay. Giving. I like to call it giving because it can be giving things like protection. Giving protection is one of the four types of giving. So I like to call it giving. So Jimba jina. Se suwarmin la. Se suwarmin la means difficult to measure. I'm sorry, not easy to measure. That's the way the Buddha says it.
Which one is which?
Tse means measurement. Su means to take. Suwa means to take. And mila means not easy. And then he gives an example in the sutra. He says, could you measure the space to the left of you, for example? How far is it to your left?
Far as what?
Just that. Okay? How far is space go to your left? It's immeasurable. And how far does it go to your right? How far does it go in front of you? Okay, there's no limit. There's no measurement. He says, trying to measure the good deeds of a bodhisattva who gives, but gives how?
Selflessly.
Without grasping to self-existence. Right? So you can be a bodhisattva and still not have achieved what? Right. Good. Direct perception of emptiness. Okay. You can be a bodhisattva long before you perceive emptiness directly. And it can also happen nearly simultaneously. So that's possible. But if you're one of those bodhisattvas who has perceived emptiness directly, and if you don't believe in self-existence anymore, although you may see it, then any time you perform giving, etc., what's etc.?
The perfection.
Yeah, yeah. Which are? This is a tiny vague ground, anyway.
Morality.
Patience.
Joyful effort.
Morality, which, you know.
Effort.
You know what that is. Patience meaning not getting angry. There's not really a good word into that in English. It doesn't mean being able to stand and wait for a bus. Although it's related. If you get angry while waiting for a bus, you did break it. And joyful effort, which means sunkangela dro'o, means enjoying good deeds. Enjoying to work hard to do good things. Okay? And then meditation and wisdom. So any bodhisattva who undertakes one of those, what are those? Bodhisattva activities, okay? If he does so understanding emptiness, then the merit of that, the good deed, is what?
Immeasurable.
It's immeasurable. It's really immeasurable. And it makes really good sense. Why? When he looks at the person he's giving something to, what does he think about that? If that person is really poor, for example, if he sees a really, really wretched person out on 39th and 9th, and he gives him something, how does he see that person? I mean, what does it mean to see the person as that?
Means that they think my past deeds have caused me to see this person.
You can think of that person as just a big bunch of dots. Just a big bunch of dots on a computer screen. Well, we'll get to there. He could be just a bunch of pixels. He could be just a bunch of random dots. That's probably his true nature. That's probably, ultimately, he's not. He's just random. And you're arranging those dots in a certain way, and you see a poor person. Okay? Who's arranging the dots? It's coming from your son. Okay? And when you give to the poor person, what's happening? When you see the person, what?
When you see the person, what?
Somebody's arranging the dots into a poor person. Who? The poor person or you?
You.
You. Alright? You.
But there are poor people. What are you saying?
Not ultimately. No, for you.
Huh?
You're
going 39th
to
poor?
If the Buddha came to 39th and 9th, would he see the same thing you see?
Yeah, but he'd see a lot of other things as well.
Gotcha. No, what? You had a class in karma. You just finished a class in karma. And to live in a place that smells bad, and a dirty place, and a place where people throw junk on the street, they walk down the street and throw junk on the street, where the city doesn't fix things, where it smells like urine when you go around the corner. What's the cause of that? Where does it come from? Is it just the budget cuts? No, you studied it. You tell me.
Karma.
Which karma?
Sexual misconduct.
Karma.
Sexual misconduct. Sexual misconduct. Specifically sexual misconduct. Those connections are hard to make. You have to study karma.
Not smelling.
You have to study karma. You have to... Karma you could never figure out by yourself, supposedly. The connections between 39th and 9th, right behind the fruit stand there, smelling like dirt, and your past karma are hard to... You cannot... It's very difficult to figure them out. You have to study the books on morality and karma. You have to study the first 16 volumes of the canon. And then you understand the connections. You can't see those connections directly until you almost reach Buddhahood. But suppose they're true. Don't have to believe it now. What would you see if you hadn't committed sexual misconduct in the past?
Gardens.
Well, you'd see something. You wouldn't be urine smell. Okay. So what would you see if you met this... If the poor person frightens you or looks ugly to you, assuming it's something unpleasant to you, then it has to be what? Where did it come from? It has to come from bad karma. An unpleasant thing cannot occur without a bad karma behind it. Impossible. Unheard of. Does the Buddha in his paradise see homeless people? In his paradise.
Well, he sees it everywhere. All the time.
In his paradise, in his own paradise, are there homeless people? No.
No, but he still sees homeless people.
He's aware of their own perception of themselves. And that's a different story. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't see that. So when you look at those dots and colors and you see a homeless person, that's because of your own projection. You see those
boxes.
Nothing to
do with the karma of that homeless person, because that would be the deception. The thought that was a person who had karma, which is causing them to...
You have no idea how he's seeing himself. I mean, what's his name? Naropa. He looked like a homeless person. He looked just like the people out there. He was a very high saint. I'm sure when he looked at himself, he had a quite different perception than all the people who met him. But he looked like a bum.
Too.
He looked like a homeless, dirty, dirty person. Okay, he did look like that. But what did he see when he looked at himself is something totally different. He was obviously a very high.
Oh, but you can even test that out in normal sort of everyday experiences, depending on who you're with. You can actually find yourself in situations where you're with somebody who experiences something so radically differently than you do that you
That's the whole point.
Sit up and notice.
That's the whole point. Generally, though, people in the same realm experience the same things very similar. Anyway, so if that bodhisattva is giving the thing to the poor person, and he sees that poor person, if it's repulsive, okay, if it's something that bothers you, then what does he understand?
Say that again?
If it's an unpleasant experience for him, assuming it's unpleasant for him, doesn't have to be, right? But assuming it's unpleasant, and he gives that poor person something, what is he thinking as he gives it?
He won't have to see that again.
That's, yeah. I mean, the virtue, if it's unpleasant, he won't have to undergo that thing. That's part of the idea of, he knows that what is before him is just the random colors and shapes. And he knows that the person who's making it a homeless person is his own mind. So he understands that if he does some kind of virtue, the whole thing could turn around and then what?
Be a pleasant experience.
Not only pleasant. What if every object in your world was pleasant? I mean, that's paradise. That's the definition. Paradise is like this. In paradise, every object, the whiteness of this wall, its flatness, the light itself, the blueness of that, your last itch, you know. Every single phenomenon elicits total bliss in you. Every object in your world. Because you've collected the karma to see those random sensations as bliss. And that's paradise. And that's... But he understands that, because he saw emptiness directly. He understood that there is not inherently or naturally any poor person there. He didn't have to be a poor person. It's a random bunch of colors and shapes, and someone's interpreting it by will,
no.
By his choice.
No.
Obviously not. I mean, I wouldn't like it to smell like urine outside. It's not by choice. It's by what? It's your past karma. It's forcing you to see those things. It doesn't help you to know that you're projecting it. You can't change it by just knowing it. But it helps a lot because then you can do what? You can behave correctly. When you behave correctly, the whole thing turns around.
So the high bodhisattva really sees this and says, well, this appears to be a homeless person. Actually, it's random collection of dots, and I really don't know what it is, but I'm going to go with my deception. And out of all the things I could choose for that to believe for that person to be, a Buddha to a homeless person, I'm going to go with the flow of the deception and treat that person as if it really was a homeless person in front of me and give to that person?
He is truly a homeless person. He really is a homeless person. And he functions that. We'll talk about that in another class. But he.
Well, but that's based on deceptive reality.
Long story. And I won't go into, it's not the point tonight.
Well, you were just saying it's not a homeless person. It's random dots.
Ultimately. Yeah.
You keep saying you see a homeless person.
Yeah.
What if you hear?
Same. Oh, absolutely the same. Thing,
okay,
smell,
so the
hear,
person
taste.
Says, I'm homeless.
Yeah.
And that's your perception.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah. If you didn't know English, if you could hear something totally different. And you know that. You know, people go into the same room. That's why read a newspaper. You can read, I remember reading newspapers in 4 or 5 countries in the space of a week about the same news event. And it was pretty interesting. You know, it's like, did they hear about the same thing or what? But that's the example. Okay. So that's how he gives. And because of that, why would his virtue be more if he understands all that?
The virtue of understanding emptiness is much greater than the virtue
why
of
is it
giving.
More, though? Why is it more virtue to sit in this class and hear this sutra once than to fill up this whole planet with gold and offer it to a high monk? Why?
Because by understanding emptiness, you can break this samsaric cycle.
You really can break it. You really can rip out. You know, you really have the information. If you're good in this class, you have all the information you need to actually stop your own suffering. And the other thing wouldn't do it. You know, giving all the gold, covering the planet with gold and handing it to the Dalai Lama wouldn't have that effect. Understanding, which is wisdom. That's all that wisdom is. The thing we just described is wisdom. That is the meaning, the highest meaning of wisdom, period. That's all you need to know. That's wisdom. Understanding his nature as you give it to him. Understanding that you're giving it to him so that he will change your projections and that your projections will project something nicer in the future. So what it means is if you really understood wisdom nicely, if you understood emptiness well, and you tried to be good at... You actually would not have any choice but to be good now. It's just... It's like smoking after learning that it gives you cancer if you don't do good things now. Because it's just stupid. It's just illogical. It's just obviously harmful to yourself to act any other way.
I hadn't noticed that ever
happened before. Oh, sure. No, oh, sure. I mean, we're talking about rational people. If you really understood all this fact, and then someone yelled at you at work, and you're about to answer with bad words, and then you understood his emptiness, you could not answer with bad words.
But you've already started it, and that's already...
The whole idea of antidote, the whole idea of wisdom is to stop yourself. But you don't stop yourself because it's the right thing to do. Blah, blah, blah. You know? You stop it because it's going to hurt you.
Well, that's the right thing to do.
That's always the right thing. And it's not selfish, you know. I know it bothers some people. It's bothered me. It's not selfish. It's just what the Dalai Lama calls intelligent. What do you call it?
Self-interest.
Enlightened self-interest. And it really is. It really is. Why create more suffering for anyone, especially yourself? I mean, you don't want to create suffering for others. And inside of that, you know, it's not selfish not to want to suffer. It's just intelligent. And that's wisdom's whole function. If you ever hear anything else about wisdom, it's just a side issue. That's the whole function of wisdom. The word dharma means dur, comes from the Sanskrit word dur, means to keep you, hold you back from making those, from blurting out those things. That's the meaning of dharma.
What is the function of wisdom?
Dur. Wisdom stops you. Dur means to hold you back. The root dur, which is where the word dharma comes from, it's always explained this way in the scriptures. It just restrains you. You're about to answer the guy back, and suddenly you remember dharma class. Oh yeah, if he's a projection, it is a lousy projection. Lousy projections do function. They will hurt me. It does hurt me. It's not saying it doesn't hurt you. It hurts your feelings, it hurts your ears, might hurt your next raise, and it hurts. Well, how do you respond? What's the smart way to respond? How do you change the reality of that person? It's totally something totally different than what the world is doing. What the world is doing is spinning the wheel again. The natural reaction is exactly what causes the wheel of life to go one more round. And unfortunately, that's our automatic reaction.
Is the understanding intellectual, or is it...
At the beginning, it's totally intellectual. Later, it becomes ingrained. But at the beginning, it's quite difficult. It's hard. It's saying that things in the world are caused by something different than what you always thought. You always thought that if you were smart, you'd get money. But dumb people get money, too. Smart people are poor sometimes. You always thought that if you worked hard, you'd get money, but some people don't do anything to get money. You always thought that if you defended yourself well, you wouldn't get hurt, and if you didn't defend yourself, you'd always get hurt. And sometimes the opposite happens. So the causation is really something quite different. Nothing bad comes from something bad. Nothing good comes from something good. If you are a good person, and if you only do good things, it would be a total... The universe would flip upside down if you get something bad from that. It'll never happen. Could not happen. And you have to live like that. But you have to live you have to realize that. And every time you react badly, it's like smoking a cigarette. It's like, okay, you're in the habit and you're addicted to it, but it's the wrong thing to do. It's harmful to you. And the wisdom, when the wisdom gets stronger, then the bad deeds get less, because you just realize it's just destructive, self-destructive.
Could you say that whole sentence?
Yeah. It's translated on the first page of your reading. But I'll say it again. When a bodhisattva who is not staying, and it doesn't say where, gives something, performs an act of giving, the virtue that comes from that is not easy to measure. And as an example, the Buddha says, okay, how far is it to my left? You know, how many inches is it to my left? You can't say. And that virtue is like that. A person who gives to the poor person on 39th Street with this kind of knowledge, as you can imagine, it's a totally different action. It's a new kind of action. It's going to create something, some kind of paradise.
Does it have more benefit for the person who it's given to as well?
That's a very good question. He's around a person with wisdom, but not directly. I mean, he gets some kind of blessing by your knowledge, but directly, no.
I mean, if they say if a bodhisattva gives something to a bird...
Well, it gives them benefit in the sense that you create a karmic relationship with them. Probably you meet them again in the future because of that, or something like that. But
the bodhisattva is giving with a wish for that being to achieve total enlightenment.
That wish doesn't help that being directly. What it does is the wish itself makes the bodhisattva a better bodhisattva, and maybe he'll meet the person. The person will become a student in the future or something like that. The way that Buddha gave his body to the tiger...
Isn't it easier to feel compassion for a quote-unquote solid human or sentient being than it is a random collection of dots?
We get there.
I'm jumping.
No, it's a good... I like the question. It's a good question. If you understood what I said, you should be wondering that. Okay. Now, the next thing the Buddha says is, just because a person looks like a Buddha, should we consider him a Buddha? And there are certain special signs and marks on a Buddha. There are certain special features of the physical body of a Buddha. And if we bump into somebody with these weird features, what are they? You know.
There are labels and conceptions.
Well, that's Slow down.
No more.
You know, he has this... it's actually a physical... It's a four she is this high. And his head, actually, his skull actually is higher. It comes up like that. It really does come up like that. And he has a very straight nose. He has a special kind of nose. He has... he really does have a certain kind of mark here. And there's a long thing that comes out. His body is gold.
What do you mean a long thing?
It's long hair, okay? If he wishes. I mean, it stays stored usually. That's a long story. He has very large ears. He has a golden color. His fingernails. He looks different than normal people. He really does look different from normal people. Very distinctive. He has certain imprints on his hands and his soles of his feet, like Dharma wheels. And his teeth are perfectly white and arranged a certain way. His hair is totally, totally black, jet black. And his clothes don't quite touch his body. They stay up like that. He has an aura. He has. You should know. It's 32 major marks and 80 minor, what we call signs.
Me too.
So he's got. There are 32. 32 very unusual major marks on a Buddha. And there are 80 lesser marks. They have to do with the shape of his hands, the shape of his fingernails, the shape of his belly button, all these different marks. But those are 112 total, very, very special marks on a Buddha. So a Buddha is distinctive. There's another kind of being called a... Do you know what Chakravartin is? A wheel emperor? Okay. There's a kind of being who, he collects this incredible good karma, and because of that karma, he becomes king of the world. King of the entire world.
Planet or universe?
Planet. Okay. And they're called wheel emperors sometimes. And they have a special instrument, it looks like a wheel. It's like some kind of very fantastic disc that they have. It gives them special powers. And a king in the old days means, you don't know what a king really means. You can think of President Clinton, he's not anywhere close. A real king owns the entire country and owns everything in it. He personally owns everything in the whole country. So he can come up to you on the street and say, you know, give me your shoes, or give me your car, or I need your car right now, just get out. You know, or I like your wife, you know. She's going to stay with me for a couple months. No, like that. A real king has all this power. I mean, and he has this kind of power. The highest kinds of Chakravartins have such a power that all the people in the world want them to be the Chakravartin. They're begging them to be the Chakravartin. They say, I don't want to be Chakravartin. They say, please, please, they beg him, you know. So this is some kind of fantastic virtue that person has. And they also have some minor marks on there. Like they have little indistinct, imperfect marks that look a little bit like some of the marks in the Buddha. But they don't have the virtue to have any of those other marks. So nobody has those marks and signs on their body, those 112, except a fully enlightened Buddha. Then, knowing all that, the Buddha asks Subhuti, hey Subhuti, if you meet somebody who has these marks, clear, distinct, all of them, 112 marks, is he a Buddha? Does that make him a Buddha? Should you consider him a Buddha?
Trick question.
Of course it's a trick question. Okay?
No.
Subhuti says no. Subhuti's pretty smart because he's Manjushri, right? And that gives me an excuse to teach you the bodies of a Buddha.
So you just described the markings of the body of a Buddha and others.
How do you mean and others?
If they don't distinguish a Buddha, then it could also distinguish a non-Buddha as well.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Okay.
Excuse me, Michael, before you go on, how do you spell dirt?
In English or Tibetan?
In Tibetan.
I thought she was a Sanskrit D-H-R with a dot.
Oh, dur? For Dharma?
Dur.
Oh, okay. In Sanskrit it looks like this. That's what it looks like in Sanskrit. In the Western philologists spell it like that. And that's the root for Dharma. Sanskrit has like 960 roots. If you understand them all, You can understand all Sanskrit.
Don't erase that yet. Sorry?
You put a dot under it, or is that a flaw in the black?
It's to represent ur sound. Ur. It's a special Sanskrit vowel.
Okay.
Alright. So, I'd like to go over the four bodies of Buddha. We'll do two maybe before the break, and then we'll take a break. Sometimes they teach two bodies, sometimes they teach three bodies, sometimes they teach four bodies. There's a big fight between the four bodies and the three bodies, but the three bodies include all four bodies. So don't worry. Now, if somebody tells you it's only three, then we can say, well, look, we know better. Give you the Sanskrit, you don't have to know the Sanskrit. It's just for people who, you hear these words thrown around a lot. Some people might like to know it. You don't have to know it. And what is it in Tibetan, do you know? What's the body in Tibetan? Honorific.
Rupa Kaya. It's Anunnaki.
Who is body? And what's in it to emanate a body? Alright. Which American people corrupt to toku. Okay.
Oh.
You don't have to know that, that's for sure. So what is the emanation body? What does emanate mean? Emanate means the real being is in one place and he's sending out. Nirman means to send out another body. He's sending out an image of himself to do some special work somewhere. And that's the meaning of Nirmanakaya.
Like an astral projection.
Like an astral projection, yeah. So the real Buddha is somewhere else, but he sends out a Nirmanakaya. You can do a chulpa without being a Buddha. You can do it just by reaching deep states of meditation. You can chulpa as a bird. You can chulpa. You know, you read like that in Western mythology and things like that. We believe you can do that also. It's described in the Abhidharma. You reach certain kinds of level of meditation. You can project yourself as different beings. A Buddha has the ability to project himself on thousands of planets at the same time. Okay. He can be showing up in different forms on thousands of planets at the same time. Millions of planets at the same time. Yeah.
Isn't it a distinguishing characteristic of the Nirmanakaya that it's particularly into samsaric realms, right?
Yeah.
It's
to help people, yeah. There is also a definition of all the bodies by who can see them. Okay, can you see a tuku? Yes. You have enough virtue. Okay. Can you see the ultimate tuku, the highest tuku? No. At least not unless you were around at the Buddha's time. So what you think of is a classical appearance of a Buddha in the world with all the 112 marks and signs, you know, that classical picture that you see, that's the what we call the ultimate tuku. Okay? That is the form that the ultimate tuku takes. Yeah, there are other kinds of tukus of the Buddha where he can appear as anything. He can appear as a deer, he did one time to help somebody. He appeared as a non-Buddhist to help somebody. And he can even emanate bridges, trees, buildings. Okay? Those, we don't call those tuku, because they're not bodies, they're not persons. But they are trupas, they are emanations of the Buddha. Trupa means an emanation which is inanimate. And he can do that also. Yeah.
Now you typically think of an astral projection.
I don't, you know, the astral is a little hard for me. The idea is right.
Right.
The word astral meaning stars. But if you think of a person sitting here and an image of him appearing in China and helping an old lady across the street, that's okay.
Well, that was my question. Usually you think of an astral projection as something sort of ethereal.
Yeah. No, he,
yeah,
he
something that
no.
does not have.
It's a very cool projection. He can project the smells, tastes.
And he's able to pick yeah. things up and
yeah.
move.
His inside is not what it looks to be. If you cut him open, he wouldn't look like that, unless he wanted to. A real Buddha's insides are totally different. But if he was wanted to carry out the projection a little more, he could emanate a liver there for you. But actually, he's not made up like that. This Trul Khu doesn't have all his guts inside and things like that. Unless somebody's a doctor and he wants to look human to the doctor, so he emanates a liver when he cuts it. You know? But otherwise, it's not like that inside. And that's the emanation body. You can see that a person who has not perceived emptiness directly can see that. You just have to have incredible good karma. Talking about the ultimate Nirmanakaya, the one that came to India 2,500 years ago. Another thing about that emanation body is that its appearing to you is totally what do you call that? What's the word in English? The Buddha doesn't have to think, oh, 3 o'clock, I better show up in Manhattan with a Nirmanakaya. It's totally, what do you call it, spontaneous. It's one of the results of the virtue of a Buddha that when there is a being who would benefit from the Buddha appearing to him at that moment, he's there. He's already there. You know, he doesn't have any conscious will that, oh, he doesn't like see the whole universe and think, oh, somebody needs me, I better get down there. When someone is ready, when someone has the karma for it to happen to him, the Buddha's there in front of him. And they say it's like the moon reflecting in all the water on earth. It's a very beautiful example. Cloudless night, total darkness, the moon is there, and every patch of water on earth, whether it's a tear in a person's eye, or the Pacific Ocean, or a puddle on the street, the moon appears there automatically. It just reflects there. The moon doesn't think, oh, I better get down into that puddle, you know. And the Buddha is the same way. The Buddha just, because of his millions of years of wishing to help people, when someone needs him, he's just there. His Nirmanakaya is there.
Is that like saying that he's everywhere in all things, all the time?
That's a different reason for that. They do say that, and there's a different reason for that.
It sounds like the moon and the water is the same idea.
Very
it's
similar.
Always there.
We'll get to that. It's coming.
Michael?
Yeah.
When you say simply appears when someone is ready, that ready is determined by that person's
virtue? Yeah, mostly. But he could have some kind of weird virtue where he didn't have a lot of virtue, but he really needed the Buddha, and you know, he had the virtue to be near the Buddha as a tukku, but could, otherwise he's a pretty lousy person. He could still appear to him at that moment. You know. But it is totally dependent on that person's virtue. Why? What we just said about the poor person. That person has the virtue to perceive a collection of atoms as an emanation come to help him. He may not recognize it. Okay, what, Vilma, you have?
No.
Okay, just amazing. So that's the emanation body. That's the easiest one to perceive. It's one of the form bodies. Okay, there's two form bodies. That's Rupakaya. So Rupakaya covers two of these four bodies. I'll do it for you like this. Well, we'll do that in a minute. The next one is... So by the way, the emanation body is mainly defined by those marks, and also by appearing in the world to help people. And he goes through, the highest emanation body goes through those 12 deeds of a Buddha. 12 great deeds of a Buddha, the mighty deeds of a Buddha. Now I'm talking not about other emanations, but I'm talking about the main emanation of the Buddha 2,500 years ago, when he showed up looking like you think of the Buddha. He always does 12 deeds. In his life, he does 12 great things. They're on the calendar in Anila's bathroom. from the British Museum. Pretty nice. But he always goes through the same play. He always goes through the same movie for the benefit of his disciples. So now we have the enjoyment body. You don't have to know the Sanskrit, just for people. I'll give you the short Tibetan version. Body is the body that the Buddha sees when he looks down in his own paradise. That's the physical body that the Buddha has in his own paradise.
His own body, the Buddha's own body. Right. Looks down and
right.
He sees himself.
It's the one that's projecting the astral projection, the physical body. It might look like these deities, like this, things like that.
Only to be seen by Mahayana Aryans.
Better if they do recognize.
So
I mean, the Buddha had a close disciple who stayed with him for 12 years. And at the end of the 12 years, he said, nothing special about the guy. He's got this little halo. Besides that, he's just a normal person. I don't see anything special about him at all. You know, I mean, he didn't have the karma, right? Very famous. So the enjoyment body is the body that you have in your own paradise. Some bullet point.
In terms of who can see Dukkha body?
Dukkha can
be
seen
by
any person who has the virtue. Does not have to be someone who has seen emptiness directly. Does not have to be a bodhisattva.
Michael, does that imply that when the Buddha leaves his paradise, that body stays there, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, Sambhogakaya is always there.
Only in the paradise, nowhere else.
I'll give you five qualities of Sambhogakaya. I'll tell you five things about the Sambhogakaya. We call the five, Nyepa means, I don't know, what you got to help me with an English word. It means a definite thing about it. There's five things that are fixed about them. It's the
Sambhogakaya.
No, but the point is that they're invariable. Invariably the same.
Absolutely.
There are five fixed items, okay?
So if you see those, you see a Buddha.
Attributes. Five definite things.
Attributes?
Five definite attributes? Okay, I'm going to give them to you in the right order.
These are five attributes.
Let's do them and then you tell me a bit. His place, where he lives, is always the same. It's always in Oakman. It's always in a paradise called Oakman. If you ever get a Sambhogakaya, you'll always be in a paradise called Oakman.
Oh, so we're only talking about Shakyamuni?
No.
What about the other paradises?
They have paradises. They're called Oakman.
So you're saying all the different paradises are the same?
Well, each Buddha has his own paradise, but it's called Oakman.
They're all called Oakman.
I believe so.
But then what constitutes Oakland if they're all, they seem to be different places?
Paradise and the Sambhogakaya. It has these qualities. Circle means, I don't know, followers. They're always Bodhisattva Arya. Arya Bodhisattva.
Mahayana.
That's kind of
my
definition, otherwise I couldn't be
here. Can you say that again? What number two?
Number two is, when he opens his eyes, he never sees a homeless person. And the only being he can ever experience is either other Buddhas or Bodhisattvas who have seen emptiness directly. Arya here means someone who has seen emptiness directly.
So those people are in his paradise.
Yeah, the only people around him, the only people he ever meets, minimum being around him is the Arya Bodhisattva. He doesn't have to put up with other people. If you're good at work, this will happen to you. I'm not kidding. I'm really not kidding. That's the whole point. That's the whole point of the class. Get away from that guy at work.
He doesn't see anybody but he doesn't have those things.
In his own paradise. In his own paradise. His Sambhogakaya.
Alright, but how does he see?
I didn't see, I shouldn't have said. His paradise body, which is his second physical body, is never exposed to any other.
Okay.
There's no one else around him.
That's a perceptual thing, or
like, everything's a perceptual thing.
I mean, you could look at say Colin Ferguson and see the goodness in him, and would not see the other things that he's done and so forth. That's the sort of thing.
Somebody asked me that. You know, I had a long talk with somebody, and they said, does that mean if I get really good and I meet Saddam Hussein, he changes from an evil person to a good person? And then wouldn't I be irresponsible? Because, okay, I'd be all right. To me, he would be an angel. But to other people, he would be a hit. You know, he'd be killing other people. And I'll just say, think about it. You have to follow the logic of what's going on. If you happen to get such tremendous karma, then when you meet Siddhanta Singh, he's like a perfect angel to you. You have to think about that. You have to think about the implications of
this. The circle doesn't mean all beings that there are in appearing in the form of Arya Bodhisattva, right?
When Rinpoche was asked this question 20 years ago, he said, what do you think, all the Buddhas are going to retire? And that's all he would say. Okay. Marx.
Marx?
Marx means, you know, the signs, he has all of them. He has all those marks in the group.
112?
Yeah. I should change, it's really called the definite quality of his body, okay? And then I'll just say 112 marks. So, sorry. Marks and signs, actually.
So are you saying the body definitely has all 112 marks of his Buddha?
Yeah. It says here, Senbei Sanzoki Drepa, which means he has the 32 marks and the 80 minor signs in their full glory.
So he definitely has all 112 because of Buddha.
Yep. Then, the Dharma he teaches in his paradise, he's teaching those bodhisattvas normally. That's what they like to do. Is only the pure Mahayana, a higher vehicle. What's that? Yeah.
So nothing else goes on there except Dharma? Is that what you're
saying? I wouldn't want to say that. But that's the main activity. And the time means until samsara ends, he will not pretend to pass away, is what how they say it. He'll stay there as long as people are still suffering. As long as anyone is still suffering. There's a lot of implications to that. It's huge debates in the monastery. This, by the way, all this comes, the main text is 8th chapter of the Abhisamalankara, which is Maitreya's text about the perfection of wisdom. And we spend about a year on it to get to memorize the whole thing.
So he stays in his paradise until samsara ends, is what you're saying.
He doesn't pretend to withdraw until that time. His body is always available there until such time as there's no one else to come.
But that never is never going to come to exist.
Well, sure it is. What are you talking about?
Well, it's endless.
What? Based on the kalpas.
No, it's an old debate in the monastery. Okay?
Based on kalpas.
It's an old debate in the monastery. I mean, if sentient beings are countless, how could there be a day when they run out? They are countless, and there is a day when they run out. We'll talk about it. Okay. These are the five. These are all fixed. It's always the same. They're called fixed qualities.
Definite
qualities. Definitenesses.
Absolute attributes.
Don't be careful with that word absolute. It's going to be very tricky in this
Could a Buddha have an emanation body that didn't show the 112 signs?
Not, as I said, there's three levels of his emanations bodies, really four. One is called the Chokitoku, which means the supreme emanation body. That always looks the same. Then there's called human form emanation bodies. He can look like, two hands, two legs, you know.
So that's why we can say that you don't know who anyone around you might be a guru.
Right. Then there's animal emanation body. And then there's inanimate emanations, which are not called emanation bodies, but he can not called a body, because it's not a being, but he can emanate a tree, or he can emanate And when they teach this in the scriptures, they always teach the four bodies with the subject of the activities of a Buddha, the influence of a Buddha, it's called chinle, okay? A Buddha's deeds, what he does. And that's defined as any virtuous thing in the universe.
Chinle or
Tinle? Chinle, it's a very common Tibetan name.
Yeah.
It means the activities of Buddha. And, very importantly, any virtuous teaching, any teaching about being good in any religion, any good deed done by anyone of any religion is the activity of a Buddha. It is a Buddha's deeds. And that's very important. That means we got to be really careful about criticizing. You know, I mean, really, when the Dalai Lama gets down to it, in a deep teaching in the monastery, and this stuff comes up about other religions, he says, look, it's the teaching of Buddha. You know, it is the activity of the Buddha. It's defined as the activity of jihad, if it's a virtuous activity. You know, jihad, if it involves killing people, is not a virtuous activity, so it's not. But if someone's teaching something, you know, Muslims teach you shouldn't drink alcohol. It's one of their tenets. That's the Buddha's activity. That's the Buddha's deeds.
Yeah.
Well,
why would he be teaching under
Hinayana? He could be teaching Hinayana. He could be teaching lesser dhammas.
Could you ask the question for me?
I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. I was asking, why would he be teaching something other than dhamma?
Yeah, it's not that he's not teaching. The choice isn't that he would not be teaching dhamma, it's that he would be teaching a different lower dhamma, like Hinayana.
Anything he does is teaching dhamma.
But in his paradise, he doesn't teach Mahayana. He's only teaching what he's talking about with those bodhisattvas is Mahayana Dharma. It doesn't mean that the Buddha didn't teach Vinaya, which is Hinayana.
Well, what about
but in his paradise.
What about him teaching Hinduism? Or
that's
if
they're
Tukul.
Okay. Michael, what's happening to all these arhats and the service bearers and all these other Hinayana people who have achieved this Hinayana Nirvana? Where are they in this?
They are the only body that they're able to see is this one.
So the same one that...
Yeah, they cannot see this body. Okay, we'll take a break, and then we'll finish the other two bodies. These are the two physical bodies. Together, they are called the form body. When you talk about Rupakaya or the form body of Buddha, when you only talk about two bodies, those things together are one of them. This is mainly produced by good deeds, as opposed to by wisdom. And its main function is to work for others, not for yourself. That's two of the bodies.
Oh, you call Rupakaya the third body?
The essence body is the emptiness.
We didn't get to the fourth body yet. Essence body is the essence, is the emptiness of bodies number 1, 2, and 4. You didn't get 4 yet.
Is there another term that is used that we might
Svabhava
Kaya?
Svabhava. Tibetans tend to mix up Sambhava and Svabhava. So you might, when you go to a Tibetan teaching, person teaching in Tibetan, they'll mix them up sometimes. Tibetan is Lo and Yiku. I mean, you don't have to know that. If you want to know it, come to the Tibetan class. Okay, you're welcome. It means the emptiness of a Buddha, his ultimate nature. That has two parts. One is the two parts are the, what should we say? The emptiness that he's always had is one of them. Okay? The emptiness that the Buddha has always had, even when back when he was a plain person like us, is what you would call his, I want to find a good word for it. Innate purity part. Okay? I don't want to get too deep into that, but you should just know that there's a part of the Buddha, which is his emptiness, which he has always had. People mistake that for some kind of Buddhahood that you have inside you and you didn't notice it yet or something like that. The Buddha nature or something like that. That's what people call Buddha nature. It's all wrong. It's a misconception. You're not a Buddha now. We wish, right? We wouldn't have that guy at work. You do have an emptiness, which when you become a Buddha will become his emptiness. So in that sense, you do have something with you now that you will have then. But it ain't like you're a Buddha and you didn't recognize it or something like that. There's no such thing.
So it was his emptiness way back when he was a simple person, but
the emptiness of his
that,
That was the emptiness of a plain person. Yeah. But those emptinesses are the same person's emptiness. Don't worry about it. I don't want to get into it. The Buddha has an emptiness. He had it when he was a plain old person. In that sense, you have something of your Buddhahood now. But it's not that you're a Buddha now. It's not that if you uncover something, you're really a Buddha inside or something like that. Not like that. That's a big misconception.
And so emptiness doesn't come in and out of existence?
Not at all.
And there's no difference between essentially...
The person to whom it's Buddha attached is the same person. His quality is different.
Go ahead.
What does Buddha nature refer to then?
The emptiness of your present mind. Which, when you become omniscient, would be the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. So in that sense, you do have a Buddha nature now. That's all. Sangye Sugyuru. Anything which will become a Buddha. Okay, second part of the essence body. You don't have to get deep into this. It's too late. It's late at night. You've worked all day. That's not my point. Essence body is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind and his cessations. What does cessation mean? The end of his bad thoughts and the end of his ignorance. They're not the same thing. Yeah, it's the second part of his essence body. That's the lack of something that went away. The other thing is a lack of something that was never there. It's a long story. We don't have to get into it tonight.
Say it again.
His cessations. Do you still have, Cheryl Creighton, do you still have a belief in Santa Claus? I mean, do you really believe that Santa Claus exists?
No.
You achieved a cessation for the belief in Santa Claus. That's what cessation is. You no longer entertain that thought. You got rid of it, it won't come back in this life. Unless you get senile or something. The Buddha has a cessation for jealousy, anger, desire, like that. He just won't have those thoughts again. What's the nature of that cessation? What does it look like? What's the nature of your not believing in Santa Claus anymore? What's it look like? It's just the absence of something. It's just something that ain't there. Like the absence of the elephant in this room is a kind of emptiness. Okay, so in that sense, they are similar to emptiness. They're just the absence of something. So we stick them into the essence body. You don't have to worry too much about it. We'll get to it year number 4 or 5, something like that. 8th chapter. Okay, body number 4. By the way, who can see that? Yeah, in a sense, an Arya can see emptiness. If you see emptiness directly, you have, in a sense, seen one of the bodies of the Buddha. No question.
One of the bodies of the Buddha that you will become for all Buddhas.
Let's say all Buddhas. Bad question. What produces emptiness? Emptiness is unproduced. Emptiness has no cause. Emptiness is a simple not being of something. What produces it is the lack of the Buddha's own... It's the fact that he doesn't not conceptualize himself as being a Buddha. And we'll get there. Double negative. Say Yeshi.
Yeshi Chukku.
In Sanskrit, Jnana Dharmakaya. If you care, you don't need to know that. I just put this here for people who are curious.
I've heard it called the Dharmakaya. What's the Jnana?
The Dharmakaya is something totally different. You gotta be careful. There's two Dharmakayas, and that's another story. Okay.
Oh, please.
Don't want to get into it. I'm trying to stick to the four bodies.
Where's the notebook?
No. This is the wisdom of a Buddha. This is the omniscience of a Buddha. This is the mind of a Buddha. There's four different parts you don't need to know about.
I thought that's what the Dharmakaya was.
No, Dharmakaya includes both of these.
Dharmakaya includes both 3 and 4, you see?
Dharmakaya consists of number 3 and number 4 together. Because the Rupakaya is the two physical bodies.
And what are you calling this in English?
I don't know.
Wisdom
Dharma body. I call it wisdom body. Because otherwise you'll confuse it with the... By the way, so does it mean that the Buddha has 4 bodies in the sense of a body? No. You can say 4 parts of a Buddha, okay? The word body is a little confusing. I noticed that Thubten Jinpa, the Dalai Lama's good, excellent translator, has stopped calling them bodies. He calls them something else. Before tarts or before, you know. That's interesting. I like that. So that's the wisdom body. That's the omniscience of a Buddha. It's the Buddha's ability to see all things. Let me make sure I covered all the homework. The Buddha is going to make a confusing statement about those marks of a Buddha, the bump on his head, the long ears, yellow color, golden color. He's going to say they are deceptive. What does he mean by that? How about Diane April gets everything right, but she never says anything. There may be a connection there. Why would the Buddha say the marks that you see on me are deceiving? What does he mean? He actually says they're false. What does deception mean? We talked about it. What's normal deception mean when a guy sells you a car and he deceives you? He presents it one way, but the reality is something else. So why would a Buddha's marks be deceptive? They look what, but they're really what?
They look one
self-existent, but they're really not self-existent. Later. There's many subtleties. Okay? So in that sense, a Buddha's marks, the signs on a Buddha, the way he looks, everything about him, is false. It's deceptive. Why? For the same reason that Deborah asked about the poor man on the street. Okay? Looks like he really is a poor man and he could never be anything else right now. But really, it only depends on what you project onto him. So in that sense, the Buddha's marks are what? They're projections. By whom? Mainly. Who's the main projector of those marks? Who gets to enjoy those marks more than anyone? The Buddha himself. When he looks down, hey, I'm golden. You know, I got this bump on my head. Long ears. You know? What has happened to his projections? Remember the disciple who didn't see anything? Except, he got this little halo, nothing else special, I don't see anything. What has happened? He's collected this virtue. He's got this tremendous, tremendous karma that when he looks down, he sees an enlightened being.
It's appearing to you. So
you look at him and you think he has to be that way, he had to be that way, it's always been that way. Probably when we met him, if we met him in our current condition, we would not see a Buddha's marks. We'd just see a normal guy. And that's the deceptive nature of his marks. You think those marks had to be there, are there concretely, from their side, their own nature. He's not just this blank movie screen, and you're projecting something onto him. That's false. It really is just that. Does that mean he's not real? No. Does that mean he can't be a Buddha? No. Does that mean like he's somehow very ethereal or something not real about him? Not at all. Only because of that can he function as a Buddha. If he weren't that way, he wouldn't be a Buddha. If the Buddha weren't empty, and if the Buddha weren't just your projections, he could never do anything. It wouldn't be there, because there's no such thing, because that's a gacha. That's a thing that doesn't exist at all. Go ahead, brother. You're going to make these people go past 9. Sure?
Well, if you don't answer me, then
okay. You
will save us all. These marks, there seems to be something very inherent about a certain level of wisdom that has no choice but to produce these marks. The black hair, for instance. We're not to take this as a cultural thing, plus some sort of an indication that you will always be able to tell somehow or another when you're seeing a Buddha when you reach a certain level.
Well, I didn't go into it very far. Each one of those marks has a specific cause that relates exactly to its nature.
Which will always appear.
It'll always be like that. In the Chöki Tukku, in the ultimate appearance of the Nyingmakaya, the highest appearance of a Tukku, the highest appearance in the universe of a Buddha will always look like that.
So on a planet where everybody has blonde hair, if the Buddha came there, they would be the only person with black hair.
If the highest appearance of the Buddha, but he might not choose to come that way since it might look odd. Alright. Last thing is, there's a place where the Buddha repeats himself. He says, the Buddha has no marks, the Buddha has no marks at all. At the very end of your reading, he'll say it twice. He says, Subhuti, The Buddha has no marks. There's no marks on the Buddha. And he says it twice. He repeats himself twice. And our commentator from the greatest monastery that ever existed, before the New York monastery.
Wow.
Says there's a big reason, okay? And I wanted to draw your attention to it. It's on your homework. Okay? In the first case, he's talking about the nature of the physical marks of the Buddha. He says the Buddha has no marks. And then he says the Buddha has no marks at all. When he says no marks the first time, he means those physical parts of the Buddha. His color, the color of his hair, the way he looks. Those are deceptive. They're empty. And you will start to know, every time I say empty in this course, it'll get more and more sophisticated. You'll start to understand what it means. What it means is when the Buddha looks down, he has the karma to see a blank screen as an enlightened being. Is there an emptiness of his mind? Which is what?
Yes, he's gone.
His mind is also a random bunch of mental occurrences. His mind is also just a bunch of random mental events. And someone is focusing on that mind and seeing what? Because of his own karma, his own omniscience. The Buddha sees himself being omniscient because he's empty, because his mind is empty. What does that mean? It means that he could have been a retarded person, could have had the mind of a bug, could have had the mind of an amoeba, he could have had an angry mind, he could have had a jealous mind, he could have had a defective mind, but because of what? He's forced to see his mind as omniscient because of what? His best karma. It's very interesting. Well, the point is, don't think we're talking about projections just with regard to the physical world. Your projections are not only responsible for all the freckles on your arm, they're also responsible for how you experience your own mind. If you have to suffer with a jealous mind your whole life, or in my case, desire maybe, that's because of your past karma. That mind is not desirous or jealous or angry from its own side. It's also a projection. The mind has its own emptiness. That's very deep. All your experiences have their own emptiness. Even your experience of your own thoughts has its own emptiness. Why, you know, has it ever happened to you that you get mad about your own anger? You know, it's like, why am I stuck with this mind, you know? Why do I have to look at those things and want them, you know? Why am I like that? Why do I have a mind that pops up these thoughts, you know? I mean, you've had times when you wish you didn't have those thoughts. It's forced on you by your karma, again. Your mind is empty. And you're also projecting onto your mind what you think. So what does the Buddha project? Total compassion and omniscience. He's got a really cool projection. Why? Because he did such good deeds. So the second marks, the whole night we've been talking mostly about the physical body of the Buddha. He's been forced to see himself as this deity. But what about his own mind? That's why Choni Dapa Shirib, the Lama from Amdo, he says, you know, by the way, the reason the Buddha repeats the word marks twice, even the marks that indicate to you that your mind is jealous tonight, is a projection. Even the marks by which you identify jealousy in your own thoughts, or the marks by which you identify desire in your own thoughts, are just projections. Your mind by itself is a blank. You're forced to experience your mind as confused because of your own karma. Yes.
You keep sounding like you're back in the mind always full, because it's not just blank. There is something out there. It's not all projection, but you keep speaking that way. I know you don't mean that, but it keeps
I do mean that.
But that's not the case.
We'll talk about it. Okay, I finished on time.
So the second marks are the omniscient of omniscience.
Yes, it's the marks.
The emptiness of the omniscient.
It's the marks that let him know he's omniscient. The indications to himself that he's omniscient. He takes those indications and he interprets them as omniscience because he's forced to by his past karma.
So that's the first time.
That's the second marks. First marks is his physical marks.
And the second marks is the marks referring to his mind.
His own mind and his own emptiness.
Which are empty.
But they're marks relating to his mind? Is that the idea?
Marks in the sense of indications. A sort of a disturbed feeling if you're angry.
No.
You know, like seeing you know,
not physical marks.
Yes, Mrs.
Go
ahead.
But he knows that
Now something very interesting. Miss Holdsworth. Mrs. Holdsworth. She asked a question. She asked, how aware is the Buddha that he's doing it? That even when he is aware of his own thoughts, how aware is he that he's just projecting it onto it? Totally aware. Totally, and you will be more and more. You'll say, yeah, I'm having more moral thoughts tonight. And it's just my own projection. And let's do more of it. Okay? It's deceptive. It's false. It's not what it looks like. But it absolutely functions. And nothing could function otherwise. Okay? The fact that it's your projections and you're aware that it's your projections is exactly why you can reach Buddhahood. And the less you're aware of that, the less chance you have to reach Buddhahood. All right.
Well, I'm also having trouble with this, but why Buddha sees things in all of them?
Huh? Ask me after.
Then why are we so much more deceptive out of all the ways we can see them?
Because it's not the way it looks to a normal person. Well, she's Umze this course, right?
I thought just for the beginning of the class.
You want? Let's do it that way. Kylie, you're Umze at the end of it.
You've seen me taught out without reaching the Yampazi Sangeshin Dumite Uwari Dokunam Darshima Sukhashu Yam Guru Rana Manavakam Niratayati Evati Kiroku Sunamishu Sososhi Sunamishu Lejongwe Tampatu Nitu Mahal